I don't know about you, but there are things I've always hoped to do before I die. Sort of a bucket list, I guess. Places I looked forward to seeing. The Great Wall of China or the Amalfi Coast. Things I wanted to accomplish. Things I wanted to be remembered for. So, to find myself in that hospital bed, isolated, not able to even see my husband or my children, literally alone and fighting for my life. It really kind of felt like I was already in the tomb. But here I am. Just call me Lazarus. It's a second chance, really. It's a chance to do those things I thought I wasn't going to get to do. I had all those hours alone to think about that list. To think about the things that I thought I would never get to do. And it made me so sad. And it made me wonder why I hadn't checked off more. If those things were so important to me, why wasn't I doing them? What was I waiting for? So, here I am, back from the dead, standing at the threshold of the tomb, bucket list before me. But here's the thing. Somewhere along the way, the list changed. Somehow, some of those things that were on my list just don't even show up anymore. Standing here at the threshold of the tomb, but with the chance to look forward and not just back? Well, some of those things just don't seem worth the time and energy it would take to check them off. Worth investing in. Because that's what it's about, this life we've been given. It's an investment. I'm so grateful for the chance to step away from this threshold for now. And I know one day I'll be back here, hopefully a lot older and wiser, but inches from stepping over. And I am beyond grateful to have the chance to think about what I want to look back on, to see what that bucket list looks like. What mattered enough to invest in. Because right now, everything just looks so different than it used to.
Today we're wrapping up our series in Ecclesiastes that we've called Positive Disruption. We're trying to figure out some things about life that seem confusing to us. We've spent time looking through the eyes of the teacher down at ground level at what he calls under the sun. And what's the conclusion of it all? What is life all about? Because it's not always pretty, that's for sure. What is the meaning and purpose of my life? What's going on? Does life have a real meaning? Should I just tick everything off in the bucket list? Or is this a moment for recalibrating like we just saw in that monologue, where perhaps the bucket list, the things that matter most, begin to change? Several years ago, my wife Gillian lost her grandmother. In a very typical Irish fashion, they held a wake in her home. Her family and friends were there. There were photographs. There were memories being shared, funny stories, really moving stories too. And in a very Irish way, they had an open casket sitting on the table. It kind of puts you off your lunch when somebody says, "Sandwiches, anybody?" and you're leaning over somebody's remains. The funeral director had done a good job. He'd made her up, fixed her hair, put on some makeup. In some senses, I suppose he's trying to make everything look a bit more bearable or a bit more presentable. But there's no way he could fake us out. Certainly not me. You put all the lipstick on a dead person you want, they still look dead. You can comb her hair, but nobody's going to believe she's actually alive anymore. It doesn't work like that. We know when somebody has actually died. And this was a wake. I've wondered about that word wake, where it comes from. If any of you actually know, you might want to take a moment and comment in the chat. I had no idea. So I actually had to look it up, and Wikipedia becomes a great source for a quick answer to a question. The English word wake comes out of the Indo-European language group with words like wog or veg, and it really means to be active, and it includes things like growth, and the veg turns into vegetables, fruit or vegetables, I suppose, get my words right, that actually grow. That's where it comes from. It can mean things like growth. It can also mean stay alert or watching or paying attention, guarding. And this idea of watching is where that word wake is used for funerals. In a sense, we stand watch. We stand watch with a grieving family, or we stand watch over the remains of someone we loved that we're about to pay our final respects to. There's another word way that we use the word wake, though. We talk about that behind a ship or behind a sailboat. You can see the wake. It marks out in the water the trajectory, the direction that the ship has been heading in. That's an interesting thing. Because sometimes when I look at the wake from a boat, I wonder about the wake of my own life. What am I leaving behind me? What will people see the trajectory of my life as having been? What will be left behind? What will the impact be? Will my life matter? Will anyone care? Will anything live on? Will there be any legacy? When they gather around for my wake and look at photographs and tell stories, will there be anything significant to say? Complicated question. I listened in the radio some time ago to Michael Jackson's business advisor discussing his life and its meaning and purpose, his legacy. They talked a lot about his unique musical talent, but there really was nothing about him as a person. Just a bizarre comment that he was worth more now than even before, as though he'd just stepped out the room for a few moments. But his wake, as it was being described, was being measured in dollars and cents. Is that the legacy we leave behind? The teacher in Ecclesiastes wraps up this strange little book, and if you've been reading the past few weeks with me, you'll know it can be tough to understand. It's complicated. We get to chapter 12, and he's trying to bring a conclusion to everything, explaining what he has discovered under the sun, not looking at it from God's perspective, just looking at it at our perspective, down at ground level. He's trying to figure it out. And he's asking questions like we are asking because none of us really knows how much time we have. But while the quantity of our time is open for discussion and conversation, the quality of our time is something that we do get to have a hand in. We do get to have some say over that, so that even if our days are short, they don't have to be empty. We can make some choices. I'm not sure all Christians actually think that way. Some of us were raised in a culture of it feels good, it must be sin, so repent and stop enjoying yourself. And yet time and again in the book of Ecclesiastes, the teacher reminds us, enjoy life to the full. If you're building a bucket list, it's okay. Enjoy those moments of life, celebrate it, live deeply. It might not be your moment to quite go all in and take up skydiving or kite surfing, but it certainly is an invitation to enjoy the life that God has given to you. Maybe that even begins in simple ways, by expressing gratitude for the things that you have, the people that are in your life, the opportunities you've had, the things you've experienced, to simply say thank you to God for those things. But there are times when we often pursue the wrong things. We make a poor choice. We change money and get greedy. We chase money. We get greedy. We become misers. We dive headlong into a career, we become workaholics, and we ignore family or friends round about us because we're too busy. We chase after sexual experiences until we become broken and don't know how to have relationships anymore. We abuse our bodies. We mortgage out our future. In reality, we worship the wrong things, and at the end, we actually become what we worship. We've seen that. We've seen the wake of other people's lives, perhaps even our own lives. The things that we've worshipped have often left a trail of destruction behind us. The teacher reminds us, pursue God first and foremost. And as you're doing that, squeeze out of life every opportunity, every joy, everything that could possibly matter. Because there's nothing wrong, inherently, with becoming successful or having a great education or career or having great relationships. There's nothing wrong with any of that. And if you're pursuing God first and foremost, God's invitation, His opportunity for you is to chase those other things too. This is what the teacher's been telling us throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. So let me read his summary, his conclusion as he wraps up in chapter 12, beginning at verse 1. The teacher says this: remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come, and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds return after rain, when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop, when the grinders cease because they are few and those looking through the windows grow dim, when the doors to the street are closed and the sound of grinding fades, when people rise up at the sound of birds but all their songs grow faint, when people are afraid of heights and of dangers in the streets, when the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags itself along and desire is no longer stirred, then people go to their eternal home and mourners go about the streets. Remember him before the silver cord is severed and the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring, and the wheel broken at the well, and the dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to the God who gave it. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. He invites us to remember our Creator when we're young. We read those stories in Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2. You probably know them fairly well. We read the story of how God spoke everything into being, and when He saw it, it was good. But He didn't just speak us into being. He made humanity with His own hands. He breathed His life into us. And then He said, it is very good. He created us to enjoy a relationship with Him. That's something that's very good. But we easily forget about God. Young people are most prone to this, most likely to actually forget about God. It's why He's giving us this reminder. And if you're watching today and you're under the age of 25, the teacher of Ecclesiastes is shooting right at you. He's saying, remember while you're still young. Because eventually there becomes so much to do, so many distractions, so many things going on, we just forget. Maybe you know that experience already. You know that I'm right. Here's the problem with this approach to life. We have so many dreams, so many things to chase. We set out life early on. We get on an education track, and it begins to drag us forward. It becomes a career path that we can no longer easily change. We choose our relationships, the ones that will be with us. And even if we try to end them, it's complicated. Even if it becomes a divorce, it's rarely easy. Life becomes really difficult. We set a path that is really hard to change once we get older. It usually looks something like this. I only pray when I'm saying thank you for my food, or when I'm really, really desperate. I never really find time or space or opportunity to spend with God. I never really read His Word anymore. My Bible's gathering dust somewhere. I look at it maybe when I need to, but not much more than that. It's what we do. We don't really spend time with God. We don't tell Him how we feel. We don't tell Him what's wrong. We don't even tell Him about what we appreciate. We just lose our way. We ignore Him. We set the direction of our life. And our choices become habits. And our habits become the direction we're going in. Statistics bear it out. The Barna Group continues to do surveys of people in North America. It would indicate that 43% of North Americans who follow Jesus made that decision before they were age 13. 64% of those who follow Jesus made that decision before their age 18. Less than one quarter of people who follow Jesus did so after their 21st birthday. Why? Because we set this direction early on. It seems to be a pattern for life for us. By the time we've made it to 25, school is wrapping up, career is beginning to emerge, we're beginning to choose lifelong relationships. It becomes difficult to make a significant move after that age, possible, but challenging. When we're 25, we want to change the world. When we're 45, we want all the stuff that there is in the world. I guess by the time we get to 65, we're just hoping we can gather up and keep hold of the stuff we've already acquired. Time slips by. We get old. We get stuck. Babies and really old people have some things in common. Usually they've got very little hair. They don't have a whole lot of teeth, and both of them wear diapers, but I shouldn't be unkind here. Old people are not quite as cute as babies, though, are they? Most of us don't really know what it would like to be old. But there's this amazing graphic description in Ecclesiastes chapter 12 from verses 2 to 6 that describes the process of aging to us. It's not very funny in many ways. It's a bit of a warning. In fact, if you're watching or listening to me right now and you're over 60, you're probably going to feel really insulted. And my only defense is, it's not me. It's in the Bible. What can I do? I've got to the last chapter. Now, not all of the things that we read in chapter 12 are metaphors or allegories. Sometimes the words are just simply referring to a broken down house, or perhaps a broken down town, or a broken nation. But at least it looks as though some of them refer to our broken bodies as we get a little older. He says things like this: the keepers of the house tremble. He could be talking about guards at a home, but he could be talking about your arms and legs yourself. They begin to shake and tremble when you get older. I've discovered that the hard way. He says the strong men stoop. I think what he's going on about here is your knees buckle when your belt won't. But if you're stooped over, it makes it easier to tie your shoelaces, I suppose, when you think about it. But the reality is your back goes out far more often than you go out. He talks about grinders ceasing because they are so few. When you get old, you sink your teeth into a steak and your teeth stay there. You end up drinking your food through a straw. Those looking through the windows grow dim. You got a 60-inch TV and you still can hardly see it. You're peering over the rims of your glasses. Driving with your face against the windshield. Doesn't really look all that good, does it, growing old, bent over, squinting and shaking? He talks about being afraid of heights, afraid of dangers on the street. It's one of the hard things about growing older. We begin to feel like we're made of balsa. Nobody needs to fall and break a hip. Things go sideways really quickly then. He talks about the almond tree blossom, the hair that's beginning to turn white. I think I should buy shares in Just for Men. Maybe it'd come in handy. You ever driven behind old people in the street? In a highway? A bunch of them in a car? They look like Q-tips in a box, but don't tell them I said that. And then he says, desire is no longer stirred. That means exactly what you think it means. The young people watching, they're always in the mood. The older crowd watching, not so much. It becomes a little tragic. They end up turning off the light to save on electricity rather than for romantic reasons. Now, I know that modern technology and science and healthcare have helped with lots of these things. Wigs can be bought when hair falls out. Dentures when our teeth fall out. We could color our hair. We could get glasses or contact lenses to correct our vision for a while. There's liposuction and Botox. If you've had a serious accident, perhaps you have an artificial limb. We even have little blue pills for other problems. But in reality, we haven't really moved all that far from the days of the teacher. The same problems still come to us eventually. And if you don't feel they're yours right now, perhaps they're your parents or your grandparents. The process continues, no matter how hard we try to hide from it. In verse 7, he says, we come from dust, and to dust we'll return. Mulch, that's all we are. I used to think that was ridiculous, so one day I looked in the mirror and saw my dad looking back at me. Maybe that's why they call it a midlife crisis. What's happening to us? The truth is, no matter how much I try to pretend otherwise, I'm getting older. Things get harder to do. I get really stiff when I get out of bed. Cells are not functioning. Joints are not moving. Life gets really challenging. And as I get older, I look back at the wake of my life. and wonder, what legacy am I leaving to my children or to my friends? You see, the reality is there is an erosion to life, and it's called aging. And just like we sometimes see erosion on a riverbank, the reality is aging is eroding our lives away from us. There is an erosion. There's also an intrusion to life, an intrusion that we call death. Most of us are probably a little bit like Woody Allen. We're not afraid to die. We just don't want to be there when it happens. I was 28. I think I was 28. And in a bid to be healthy, had eaten a bowl of vegetarian chili. I thought this was going to do me some good. It was made out of a meat substitute called corn. It tasted fine. But very quickly, I ran into trouble. I had trouble breathing. I wasn't feeling well. Something was happening to my skin. And I discovered the wonders of anaphylaxis. Some of you know about that, or your children or grandchildren struggle with it. The serious allergic reaction that can be life-threatening if you don't have your EpiPen handy. It begins to affect all sorts of systems in your body, your GI tract, your respiratory system, your cardiac system. All things kind of go sideways in a hurry. Sometimes it's from bee stings. Most often it's food. Nuts for a lot of people, dairy products for some. In this case, this meat substitute called corn was made out of something called mycoprotein that my body doesn't like very much. Anaphylaxis creates all sorts of problems, and if it's not treated well or quickly, it can go south. It could lead to death. At the hospital, I was treated properly. Oxygen, steroids, antihistamines, epinephrine, or adrenaline. The physician told me I'd feel my heart race when he put the epinephrine in, and at that point, I was feeling so bad I couldn't care less. What happened at that point wasn't so much my heart racing as an explosion. I remember a couple of things quite clearly. The first was the doctor screaming, "How do I reverse this?" The other was an impending sense that this was the end. And ridiculous as it seems, my final thought before I passed out was, imagine dying over eating vegetarian chili. I thought I could have died in a more spectacular way than this. I closed my eyes, no white light, no nothing, and when I came to, it became apparent what had happened. The dose of epinephrine was wrong. They'd given me too much. Not great for your heart to make it explode like that. And for the first time ever, the fragility of my own life became apparent to me. Several years later, it became very real when I lost my mom and she passed away. The teacher tells us about this intrusion to life. And he says in verse 7 that when dust returns to the earth, breath returns to God who gave it to us. In fact, back in chapter 11, verse 9, he says this, "Follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment." There's an evaluation. There's a final exam at the end of life. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 27 puts it like this. Just as people are destined to die once, and after that, to face judgment. Life's final exam. It's why the teacher is encouraging us to remember. He's encouraging us to look back and remember our Creator. He's encouraging us to look forward and remember our judge. Many of you have probably had enough of exams. Diplomas are over. You're sick and tired of school and studying and writing papers. It's time to lighten up and do something really different. There's been enough remembering for a while. But when the teacher tells us here, remember, he's not just simply saying, don't forget, cram hard for life's really final exam. That's not quite what he means. One of the beautiful stories of the Old Testament is of a young lady called Hannah who wanted to have a baby and she couldn't. And she prayed, and she prayed, and she poured her heart out before God. And one day, Hannah discovered that she was expecting and was going to have a baby boy. You can read it in 1 Samuel chapter 1. It says there that God remembered Hannah. He didn't just have fond thoughts about Hannah. When it says he remembered her, he did something for her. He acted decisively on her behalf. And when the teacher is inviting us to remember God, remember our Creator, remember our Judge, remember where you came from, remember where you're going, he's asking us to act decisively towards God. What does that look like? What does acting decisively towards God look like? He begins by telling us to use the time wisely. In verse 8, he repeats his common refrain, meaningless, meaningless, everything's meaningless. In the first message in this positive disruption series, we looked at that word meaningless and all the things it could mean, including just breath, like water vapor coming out of your mouth on a cold day. It's there and it's gone. Steam from your kettle, there and it's gone. It just vanishes. And he's saying to us, there's an urgency to life. It's shorter than you think. You think you've got a long time. It feels like a long time. And then one day you wake up and there's not so much time left anymore. There's an urgency to life. We're all in the process of dying. Death hasn't come to us yet, but it rattles its chains a little bit. And perhaps if it rattles its chains, it could stir us into action to use the time wisely. Maybe it means simple things like this. If you've got a steak at home, eat it quickly while you've still got teeth. If you've bought new runners, use them while you can before your knees give out. If you love someone, give them a kiss. You could do it right now while I'm speaking. If you've discovered the wonder of God's love, then pursue Him. Can I ask you, what are your dreams and ambitions? What would you really like to accomplish in your life? Maybe you're young and you're trying to figure that out. Maybe you're a little older and thinking there's only so much time left and it feels a little bit more like your bucket list. What do you dream of? What would you hope for? What new challenge would you like? What would you love to change in our world if you could? What kind of impact would you like to leave behind you? What would your legacy or your wake be? Maybe if you know that or you're feeling strong enough to do it, you could share that in the chat right now. Let some of us know, what would you really like your life to be remembered for? The first digital camera, as far as I can tell anyway, was made by Kodak and released in 1991. It weighed 8 pounds and cost $13,000. Could you imagine it for a camera? Nikon was the first company, though, that went to making a digital SLR, single lens reflex, one that you can change lenses on. They already had a strong customer base, and so when they made their digital camera, they made it to make sure that all of their existing users could use their existing lenses. Everything had to fit. That meant, though, that things needed to be a slightly different size than they would have wanted at first. They had to put a smaller chip in, and as it turns out, it really wasn't functioning as well as they actually hoped. Canon took a very different approach. They completely reinvented their SLR camera. They released theirs in 2003, but that required all sorts of new lenses, and guess what? People bought them. In fact, Nikon's customers began switching to Canon, and one was going down as the other one was going up. It's really what happened. Canon became the new industry leader. By 2003, Kodak was struggling, not just technologically, they were struggling to stay afloat as a company. They had miscalculated how long it would take for digital cameras to take over. They'd expected it to be around 8 years. Within a couple of years, digital was far outselling film. They had almost lost their company because of their speed. They didn't move fast enough. They didn't anticipate the change that was coming. The mistake that Nikon made was lack of commitment. They didn't want to upset their customer base. They wanted everybody to use what they already had. And so they didn't go all in. They stuck some toes in the water, but didn't go the whole way. Years later, to their credit, they completely reinvented themselves, became a fantastic photography company making cameras and lenses. Canon was right on target, though. They took a risk. They aimed for the future. They were focused on it. They weren't just preoccupied with what their customers may or may not want at that moment in time. They took the risk to reach new customers. They didn't react to change. They became change leaders. Don't waste the opportunity, the teacher is telling us. Don't miss out. Don't wait for something to happen. Don't live your life with regrets. Experience life. Go for it. Make a difference. Invest in the lives of others. Enjoy today. Use your time wisely, however much you think you've got. But acting decisively for God, he also reminds us that we should read the book. Verses 9 through 12 talk about that. Read the book, read our Bible. I love reading some of the works of N.T. Wright, a great Bible scholar. He once describes the Bible like this. He said, the Bible isn't like an accurate description of how a car is made. It's more like the mechanic who helps you fix it. It's like the garage attendant who helps to refuel it. It's like the guide who tells you not only where you're going, but how to actually get there. And where we're going is to see God's new creation happen in this world. We're not just trying to get through life unscathed and unscarred. We're here to make a difference and see God's new reality begin to emerge through the way we live and love and serve. Sometimes reading our Bibles can feel like a struggle. I know that. And at other times it becomes such a source of delight and comfort, we can't get enough of it. Sometimes obeying God's word seems like a real challenge, like a grit your teeth and bear it as though you're working out. And at other times it feels like it's given us such freedom when we do. But when we do read and obey, we discover God creating space in our hearts and in our lives and in our world for us to engage with him and see things begin to change round about us. We discover his dream for his world, and he wants us to be involved. Are you ready? Are you ready to be involved in God's dream for his world? Read the book. Because Jesus infuses our lives with meaning as we follow him. He gives us this life-giving word. He is God's life-giving word. Read the book. Discover the plans that God has for you and your life. There's one more way we act decisively. It's really the big conclusion in verses 13 and 14. Now, all has been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it's good or evil. Fear God. Fear God, that's the point. A right relationship with God. Throw yourself onto him and discover his presence and his grace and his mercy and his love in your life. Discover the purpose in power and direction he can pour into your life. Be amazed at how much he loves you and learn how to love him in response. Commit your life to him. Commit your future to him. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. That's the invitation. Some of us wish we did remember our Creator in the days of our youth, but we've got older. We feel like we've blown it. We forgot. We made some changes. We've gone off into left field somewhere. It's not always gone well for us. Do you know what? When you feel like that, God's not far away. He's closer than you could ever think. When you feel furthest from God, he's just about as close as he's ever going to be in your life, because he never gives up. He never walks away. He never runs out on you. He's waiting for you today. He loves you and pursues you. And the gap that you very legitimately feel in your life, Jesus has come to close that gap, to bring you home again, back into God's family. That's what he does. He enables us to remember our Creator, to live lives with passion and power and purpose. He came to give you life more abundantly. So why don't you just tell him how it is? Tell him the truth. Fess up about what's gone sideways. God knows anyway. You won't shock him or surprise him or put him off. But when we tell him, we unburden ourselves. And we create this space somehow for God to be at work, changing our lives and changing everything about us. It's time to set this new direction in life, to allow God to lead and we follow as his purposes come apparent to us. It's time for me, it's time for you to recalibrate. And when you do, watch out for the wake. Watch out for the legacy. Watch out for what God is going to do in your life. Would you pray with me for a minute, please? Father, today, thank you that you love us so much, you gave Jesus for us. Thank you that you didn't just leave us under the sun, dealing with the challenges of life that so often feel futile and frustrating. As life begins to erode and the intrusion of death comes along, but thank you that you entered into our life, into our world in Jesus, that we could know you, that we could receive your forgiveness, your grace, and your love. And so today I want to pray, and perhaps you want to pray with me right now. You even click on the track, on the chat that simply says, Jesus, I need you right now. And Jesus, I'm saying yes to you right now. I'm asking you to forgive me, to change me, to give me a brand new start, to set the direction of what's going to happen next. And by your strength, by your spirit, I'm going to follow. And Lord, I want to pray for all of us too that kind of feel somewhere we got this badly wrong. We started out okay. We feel like we've blown it. We've gone too far. Thank you that that's not true. And so right now I pray for those of us that find ourselves there, that we would know that as we tell you the truth, here I am, broken, with bad choices and lots of consequences. But I pray you'd forgive me. I pray you give me a new chance. A chance to do life with you. A chance to do life under the sun. A chance to discover your purpose for my life. Because that's all that we all want, really. To know that there's meaning and purpose. And so today, as we commit ourselves to you, Lord, we pray that you would help us to discover your purpose for us. That our life would be meaningful. Our legacy would be strong. And that Jesus would be made visible in how we live, because we pray in his name and for his sake. Amen.